I have to confess that I originally had intended the title to be Technology, Where Are We and Where We Are Going? But I came to realize as I looked at this further, as I was preparing this, that I don't have the foggiest idea where we're going. And so we'll go with the title that I have had on my notes, and I think that's title that is put on the board, the schedule board, and the title that Larry Rasmussen used this morning to announce it, and that is Technology, Where We Are and Where Are We Going? I'm going to talk today about how far we have progressed in terms of what some of our machines can do. This session today is the first in a series of five sessions that we'll be doing this week on technology and spirituality. And I'll just go through those very quickly for you now. Tomorrow, I'll be talking on the influence of technique on our society. This deals with the implications or is a statement that the implications of technology run far deeper within our society than just what we see within the realm of machinery. Machinery just is part of the whole technological question, that in fact techniques go much deeper into the fiber of our society than just our machines would reveal. Then on Wednesday, the title of that session will be What Will Happen When We Can Synthesize Music Perfectly? That raises some interesting questions about what it means to make music, and it raises interesting questions not only that, but about the whole creative processes that we're involved in. So I think that'll be kind of interesting. And we'll also talk that day about some of the responses of the human spirit to some of the high technologies that we have in our society today. And for that, I'm going to use sort of as a basis of that a book, Megatrends, by John Nesbitt. Then on Thursday, I'm going to talk about to what end do we worship competency? To what end do we worship competency? And I maybe will take a pot shot or two at a few of the sacred cows that we have in that regard. And I'll talk to the extent about the extent and the magnitude of some of the problems we've gotten ourselves into because we perhaps have idolized technology and competency in some ways. Then on Saturday, the session will be entitled Living Humanly in a Technological Society. And there we will deal with some questions about what can we do about some of these things. Where can we find some hope in a society that is becoming so technologically oriented? I'd like to recommend to you some tapes that were taped of sessions here at Holden by David Bella, who is a professor of engineering at Oregon State University. He has some very good tapes. I've heard one or two. They're in the tape library. I particularly recommend to you one of his tapes, What is Time? It's an interesting look at the extent to which society, or to which technology has pervaded our society, and the extent to which we are, we have been drawn into certain modes of life as a result of the advancement of techniques. David Bella is the speaker, Bella. And he has a number of tapes in there, so I would encourage you to read them, or to listen to them, rather. I'm going to tell you the message of this whole series that I'll be doing on technology essentially is the following. It's sort of the end line here, punchline. We are immersed in technology from the tops of our heads to the tips of our toes. Essentially, every one of us are, not just the scientists and engineers, every one of us are, and that we are being swept along toward a world of ever greater efficiency, precision, control, and all kinds of other words like that, and that we need to consider from whence comes our hope in such a society. So the theme of the week is going to be, how can we live in a society which is has such a pervasive technological nature to it? Just a bit of my background so you'll know the context from which I speak. I am an electrical engineer by profession. I have an engineering company in Minneapolis now. Our business is interactive graphics with computer systems. There are systems wherein human beings interact with various images generated by a computer. My history is, for a number of years, I worked for the Atomic Energy Commission, developing particle accelerators to be used in high-energy physics. Those were the devices that were used for looking at the finest particles of matter that we're able to look at, and I'll describe that a little bit later for you. And then later I became involved in image processing by a digital computer. And a good deal of that has been applied to looking at the planets. You perhaps have seen pictures from time to time of Mars, Pluto, some of the moons of Pluto, Neptune. Those kind of pictures are processed by digital computer. And so I've had the opportunity to look at some of the finest things that we have looked at in terms of the smallest and also the remotest in unmanned or unpersoned space exploration. Okay, moving on. First, I'd like to just cover some of the technologies that we have today. A lot of these will just be review for you. I'm sure you're exposed to these frequently, or at least you do get exposure from them, as I do, through some of the excellent publications available to us. High technology, that term is very ill-defined these days, but I think we have kind of a notion that it is the most advanced technology that we have, has entered into almost all areas of our lives. Medicine, manufacturing, education, office automation, power generation, transportation, communication, home conveniences, entertainment, law enforcement, military weaponry, even art, music, and many other areas. In fact, it's hard to find an area within our society that has not felt the effects of high technology. And we hear new words springing up that are really new to our ears, and I think scary sometimes. They frighten us sometimes. Genetic engineering, for example, is a frightening terminology when we think of what that might mean. We have clearly entered the frontier of outer space. The space shuttle, which is something that we're all familiar with now, which is a fully manned craft, when I grew up, was mostly what we heard of in Buck Rogers and Flash Gordon. It seems like in just a relatively short time, that has become a reality for us. We have witnessed in the past, seemingly few years, just spectacular experiments in terms of unmanned space flight to the planets. We're looking with eyes, essentially, at Mars and at the moons of our various remote planets. We have moved a long ways into that area. I'd like to just describe that process so you get a feel for the complexity of it. As you are aware, probably, we send out unmanned space or unpersoned spacecrafts to the remote planets. We send them so that the gravitational force and interaction of all the planets work together to bring them by, say, one of the planets. I'll indicate it as Mars. We have eyes, essentially, then that look at Mars in the form of cameras. Those camera signals, electronic signals, are transmitted back to Earth. They're collected in very large antennas that cover, they're very large in area. That information then is transmitted back to a place. It's generally Jet Propulsion Laboratory in Pasadena, California. In Pasadena, then the information is processed by huge, huge computer systems. The information in the images is enhanced. Usually these signals coming back are very noisy in terms of electrical noise. So if we were to look at them as we received them, they would just be gray almost. And we process them by very large computers. We measure the data automatically by computers, and we end up with a very very neat pictures that we see in National Geographic as a result. That whole process is exceedingly complex technologically, but is a thing, I think, of wonder to be able to see that far into outer space, essentially giving mankind eyes that will reach for millions of miles. I can't remember what that was. I think that was 200 million miles to Mars in the Viking 1 and 2 programs. And the Voyager spacecraft have now gone to Pluto. Voyager 1 and 2 spacecraft launched in 1977 have revealed spectacular images of Jupiter and her moons. And now that the spacecraft traveled on toward Uranus, which it will pass in 1986, and Neptune, which it will pass in 1989, and then it will move out of the reaches of our solar system entirely. And also, in terms of looking into the universe, into the depths of the universe, we have huge radio telescopes with antennas that cover acres that look out into the very depths of the universe. It is a cause for awe. Similarly, we are reaching into the depths of the tiniest particles of matter. I'd like to describe for you just very quickly how that, looking at the other end, we build particle accelerators. Generally, we do that by inserting charged particles into a magnetic ring. The particles then go around the ring at incredible speeds. We accelerate them. They continue to go until they reach the speed of light. They become relativistic, that's called. And then as we try to increase their speed, they no longer go faster. But what happens is they gain greater energy, and their apparent mass becomes greater and greater and greater and greater until they're very energetic particles. They're moving very fast with the speed of light, with apparent masses that are very great. Then we collide those with some target, liquid hydrogen or something, and the result is that we have particles that leave the collision. And those particles are the subatomic particles that are the things, the very smallest particles that we can observe that make up our matter. And we have eyes that see very, very fine detail of matter as a result. And we hear words like quarks and leptons, which are the fundamental particles which hold together nuclei. And So our eyes are getting very fine in terms of what we can see in fineness, and also what we can see in terms of the distance of our universe. And now, just a little slight, bringing this somewhat full circle, we are even talking of bringing these things together, and this is perhaps the negative part, and not perhaps, I think it is the negative part. We're talking about bringing these particle beams together with some of these techniques into what I think is a more hideous use of them, and that is particle beams for weaponry to be directed at satellites in space that would be used for war. So we come kind of full circle with these two extremes in a way that needs some critical questioning on our part, I think, as a society. Another thing that I think, from a technological standpoint, which is perhaps having the most profound effect on us in our society, is a thing called the integrated circuit. You perhaps have heard about the chip. I have one back in my room, and I forgot to bring it with me. I wanted to show you a computer on a chip, just a tiny little thing, about 1 inch long. It is as powerful as the computers that I recall working when I was doing high-energy physics in that occupied a room at least this size and which cost $2 to $3 million. Now they cost $35 to give you a feel for the difference and the speed at which things are moving. Very, very large computer systems are being developed now, and it seems like in our business, every year or so, we hear of a new computer that can do 2 to 3, maybe 4 times as much as it could do 2 years ago or a year ago. The advancement is just simply incredible. in that area. And it's due to this chip that I'll bring tomorrow. I'll bring it tomorrow so you can see it. The advancements in the mass production of these chips. And they're not just moving into the areas of research. They're moving into our homes. Personal computers use these. You've heard about the personal computer revolution. It is taking place. I saw a recent news program that Carnegie Mellon Institute is considering a requirement that all students have a personal computer, and that they predict that they will have 7,500 personal computers on that campus within a year or two. I'm not sure about those statistics, but I think they're close. Can you imagine it? 7,500. Everyone has their own personal computer of the magnitude that we used to design those machines at the cost of $2 to $3 million not so long ago. They're extremely powerful. The personal computers are extremely powerful processors. They're found in many places that we don't even know about. They're moving into our homes, our automobiles, our offices, nearly everywhere. I think it's kind of a curious thing to note with regard to how pervasive computers are. The space shuttle, I believe, and I'm quite sure this is the case, the space shuttle can fly without the human being, but it cannot fly without its computers. It can fly without the human being, but not without its computers. I would like to just read for you just some very quick excerpts here from some of the technical journals that I have. In preparing for this, I wondered how maybe we could get a quick look at how pervasive technology is today, and I simply picked up the last year's issues of a number of journals I have, and I'd like to just read a few paragraphs for you from them. These will be more oriented toward electrical engineering and computer engineering, but I think if we were to look at any scientific or technological discipline, we would probably find the same sort of things coming through. So let me just read these to give you a kind of a broad brush of what is being said in these journals. The digitization of America, that is the use of the computer chip, which is a digital device, the digitization of America and other advanced nations is continuing with little indication of a slowdown. Very large-scale integration promises to enhance this digital trend as it enables the wedding of computers and instrumentation and the wider dispersal of computer power to nooks and crannies previously unthought of. The computer is thus insinuating its way into everything from electronic funds transfer and the power utilities to the factory floor. Another one. Olympic athletes intent on breaking world records are turning to sophisticated software programs and high-speed computer systems to plot their performances and find ways to improve them. The software and computer systems analyze slow-motion movies of an athlete's movements and estimate bone and muscle stresses in relation to the movements. From this information, it is possible to postulate some optimum movements that might help an athlete break an existing record. You're starting to catch some of the words that denote our technological society. Optimize. Can you imagine that? Optimizing our athletes so that every ounce or every twitch of the muscle is working to make that faster speed. And this, incidentally, is a characteristic of our technological society. These words like optimize, make more efficient, be more productive, are words that do characterize this society. Many good things, of course, technology. Here's one. Microelectronics is opening new ways, and I'm not saying that optimization of the athlete's movement isn't good. I don't mean to imply that at all. And I don't mean to imply technology isn't good. I do mean to say that it has bad as well as the potential for good. Microelectronics is opening new ways for 1.8 million deaf people in the United States to hear others. With data processors in a chip, it is now possible to build hearing aids that alter speech according to the individual needs of those with impaired hearing. Training equipment, for example, can make use of a child's sense of sight or touch to teach word pronunciation. Telephone links can be adapted to convert spoken words into printed words on a teletypewriter and vice versa. And one on speech synthesis. I need some of it. Speech synthesis. The production of intelligible speech from computer data is no longer a novelty. Text-to-speech products with unlimited vocabulary are available as automated readers for the blind, and in the next 2 years they will be incorporated into telephone-based inquiry systems that will give users access to databases from any phone. Though these devices do not yet have fully natural-sounding speech, their quality is improving rapidly. Speech chips with limited vocabulary are already at a quality level comparable to that of tape recorders. We will see the time when there will be translators that will carry around in our pocket. You know, I'm struggling so hard to learn Spanish now, like in reverse. Maybe I'll just have a translator that will fit into my vest pocket before I learn how to speak Spanish. That will come. There's little question about that. Another one. The small, stocky man in blue overalls picked up the welding torch, turned to the unfinished transmission casing on the workbench, and with a slight nod, dropped the protective hood over his face. With a searing white light, the torch sputtered liquid metal a foot in all directions. After a few minutes, the worker passed the casing on to his colleague, a robot. The 4-foot mechanical arm clicked into action, tracing the outline of the transmission casing with another torch. After 12 minutes, the part was finished. The man had done the intricate work. The robot had followed with the easy work. Another one. Years of industrial robot development, refinements, and improvements are beginning to pay off. The industrial robot, a programmed manipulator designed to work automatically, is becoming as much a part of a manufacturing plant as a punch press or drilling machine. Its integration into many machining centers and production lines has been so smooth that it is hardly distinguishable from the vast machines it works with side by side, save for its moving appendages. No longer is the industrial robot thought of as a custom tool for a simple task. Modern robots can be taught a variety of tasks, some very complex, by the use of simple computer languages and by operator teaching methods that literally lead the robot by the hand. The blending of electronics and mechanical engineering is making possible a new class of smart robots. Robots are casting, spray painting, welding, loading and unloading, and assembling and sorting parts among a myriad of jobs, and they are acrobatic workers. They can work on the factory floor, on tracks in synchronism with moving production lines, on overhead tracks hanging upside down, mounted sideways on walls, or in any other configuration the human mind can conjure up. This operating flexibility, coupled with quick and easy adaptability to changing job requirements, have made robots desirable workers. And we have international conferences now on robots. That's a regular thing. There's an international, I don't know the name of it, an international association of robotics. And within our business, there are associations like that. Sleuthing by computer. This is an account of how computers are used in our law enforcement, and that's extensive. Just a word about some of the what the thought is with regard to some of our defense technology. A debate is raging in the Pentagon over how deeply the United States should commit itself in the 1985 budget and thereafter to highly computerized weapon systems. Advocates, Defense Secretary Caspar Weinberger among them, say the systems could revolutionize conventional warfare by the year 2000 and could lessen the likelihood of nuclear war by dramatically increasing America's ability to win a war without using nuclear weapons. But other military and civilian officials fear that weapons so complex would not be reliable and that radical changes in tactical planning and organization would weaken the military. The weapon system would link arrays of advanced electronic, acoustic, optical, and other sensors with computers of enormous capacity and ultimately with precise munitions, such as missiles with homing devices that are so accurate that one shot will be as destructive as 10 are today. One advocate likened the sensors to human eyes and ears, the computer to the brain, and the precise munitions to the fists. Information about an enemy could be obtained, processed through a computer, and precise munition fired in millionths of a second. The enormous boost in computational power resulting from this large-scale integration of the chip will produce a force multiplier effect, tending to offset any numerical disadvantages that the United States forces might face in the future. So we're hearing things like force multipliers. All this stuff, I think, is it's what people in my business read on a daily basis, and it's the type of thing that whether we like it or not, we seem to be drawn into. Yes?
Just a quickie aside, just a quickie question. Who is doing all this advancing, all this high technology? Do we have to go overseas? Are we able to have the processes to work here, the areas of high technology? Are they getting it all over there?
That's a good question. Are we getting it from overseas, or are we doing it? Is that your question?
Yeah.
Well, there clearly has been now an advance in the technological capability of other countries, particularly Japan, as we have heard so much about. And we fear that our technological situation or capacity in this country is dropping as a result of some of the practices that we've been engaged in. And I think to a considerable extent that is true, that may be happening. That other countries now, the United States for so long has enjoyed a very extensive technological lead, but now other countries are gaining access to it as well.
I was wondering who had written the articles that were our
local. Oh, these articles are written in the United States. And make no mistake about it, there is an enormous amount of technological development in the United States. And one thing I wanted to say, and I'm going to cover this in more detail tomorrow, and that is that technology...
We're going away, so tell us.
What's that?
We're going away, so...
Okay, I'll tell you now. Technology begots technology. That is it's a characteristic of it, and we see it so clearly today. In my business, computers create computers. The process is just... It builds on each other. We use computer systems that we designed 1 year ago to design the computer for next year. And we mass produce now the chips that I talked about before. And those mass production processes are made possible by the very chips themselves. And it is what we call technologically a regenerative process. It regenerates very quickly. And so those that have the technology continue to get it and continue to almost at a just an exponential growth rate develop technology. And that's what is taking place. And another characteristic I'm going to talk about tomorrow is that the technology in and of itself presses on to ever greater increases in efficiency. And as it does that, it tends to move the human being out of the way, because the human being tends to introduce, through his or her frailties, errors. That's why the space shuttle can fly with its computers. It needs them, but it doesn't necessarily need the human being. And you can see that happening throughout society, and that's part of the issues that we'll be talking about this week. A thing comes to mind. At our supermarket now, the clerk simply runs the loaf of bread over the scanner. We're being relegated to moving the potatoes over the scanner. And the human being is being moved out. But that's for more talk, perhaps, in the next few sessions. Where are we going? I'm going to duck that question just for a few minutes to take a look, just a very brief look at the past. Mankind has always utilized technology throughout the history of mankind in the broadest sense of the word. Man hasn't always had the fancy, super complex machines, but he or she has always used technology. Technology applies to the flying of the space shuttle. It applies and applies heavily to the making of a McDonald's hamburger. Do you know how systematized that is? Working toward efficiency, optimization. Even our scheduling of Holden activities here is systematized. It's pervasive with us.
Is it done on a computer?
No, but any day I'm thinking someone's going to be asking, can you do it on a
computer? Can you be replaced by a robot?
Unfortunately, it probably can't. But even our early ancestors used systematic methods for developing fires. I mean, very quickly, very early ancestors learned that if you did it a certain way, in fact, you could get an expected result, and that would be a fire. So the whole technique, the whole thing of technique has been with us since the beginning of mankind. Modern technology had its birth at the time of Francis Bacon. And to a great extent, to a great extent the forefather or the father of modern technology. He introduced the scientific method. Modern technology, since that time, has marched along essentially unimpeded, although there have been times throughout this history now of modern technology and science where the church has resisted it, and there has been resistance from certain romantics, William Blake, for example, other persons have been able to, I think, see what some of the dangers have been that technology, at least its uncontrolled progress, would have. And we have been hearing these words from persons like that. But generally speaking, modern technology has moved along in an unimpeded way. We've applauded it and accepted it pretty much. It has brought many good things to us. We can just list a very large list of them. Then the question should arise, I think it is starting to come up now, particularly in the past 2 decades, and that is, who has been deciding what technology should be implemented? Who in our society is deciding that? And when we ask that question, we come up with not a surprising answer, but kind of one that catches us off. Nobody has been. Nobody has been looking at what technology should be implemented in our society. The reality is that for the most part, technologists are so specialized and the whole picture of technology is so complex that no one seems to know what's going on from the overall point of view in technology. We're intent on doing our narrow jobs, and as technology becomes more complex, we find ourselves on an increasing basis looking at narrow areas. And so there is hardly anyone able to look at the overall picture.
Well, about the NASA program, that's pretty specialized. They seem to be well organized.
They are well organized, NASA perhaps is somewhat of an example where we are starting to look at what some of the overall implications are. Although the emphasis on the NASA program has been more of this: take the technology that we're learning in the outer space programs and apply it to our daily lives. That's been, to a great extent, the basis on which the NASA program has been justified. That is, the extent to which technologies can come out of the space program and be applied to our daily lives. So even the NASA program tends to reinforce this movement of technology as fast as we can into our everyday lives. Did you have a question?
Yeah, what about the Battelle think tank? You know, they go through all.
Yes, they do that. You're saying that they do attempt to assess.
I know in Seattle we have that.
Yes. Mm-hmm. There are, in the last 2 decades particularly, we have recognized that we do need to look at both the good side and the bad side of technology. And we have started to do that, and that's a case. The Battelle Institute. Mm-hmm. We've had other organizations set up. We even now have an Office of Technological Assessment, I think that's the name of it, or it's something very close to that, that operates within the United States Congress, or for the Congress, that makes such technological assessments. And in the early 1970s, we did at a high level reject something, at a very high level. A supersonic transport was rejected as a technology that had too many environmental negative effects. So, and there may have been some other political things that entered there, but at least to a certain extent, we rejected on a very high level a new technology. Whether we can be successful in assessing social impacts of specific technologies and then balancing the good over and against the bad is, I think, a real question. It's tough. The problem is that it's very hard to predict the future values of our society over and against which we can weigh what a new technology will do. And therefore, we have tended, and probably will for a long time in the future, only be able to make technological assessments retrospectively. That is, we'll be able to, the technology will be developed, and then we'll look back and say, what did it do? We'll look back. That's the only thing we are able to do at this point in time. So I think that the question, where are we going from here, remains essentially unanswered, and that probably will be remain unanswered for a long time. We'll be talking some more about this in the next few sessions. But I wanted to give you one example of how difficult it is to foresee some of the good and bad of a technology. At the turn of the century, the automobile was perceived as being the perfect solution to pollution. Can you imagine that? The automobile was perceived as being the perfect solution to a severe pollution problem. At the turn of the century, 2.5 million pounds of horse manure and 60,000 gallons of horse urine were deposited on New York streets alone. Can you imagine? That has to win the award for the dumbest statistic stated at Holden this year. But when you think about it, it isn't so funny. That was an enormous pollution problem for the city of New York at the turn of the century. People perceived the automobile as being the ideal solution to it. We don't perceive it quite that way today, do we? I'm going to close with that and ask if there are any more questions or if there's any other discussion on today's session.
Hasn't the motivation for a lot of progress changed in the last generation or so? You don't have much pure science, and certain companies hire the scientists, and it's a profit situation that motivates the researchers. That's kind of what's happening.
Yes, we have entered an era of what I guess we would call applied science, where we are now almost struggling for the application of some of the scientific things we've had, struggling to find new products to integrate.
Nobody has an overall view.
Very few do have an overall view, and the almost insatiable appetite we have for profits and for new products as a result of that have put our country, particularly the United States, over and against Japan, into a situation where we look for very short-term utilization of the science. Basic science itself tends to be long-term. You generally don't see the utilization of it for years, if ever, and applied science tends to be much shorter term. Yes?
You were talking about the school requiring their students to get the computers, but by the very fact that they're going to require them to have computers, unless they have some means of updating those daily, those computers are going to be outmoded by the next year.
Yeah, the point is that if they buy 7,500 computers, they're going to be outdated in a year. And
much like buying a camera today and finding another camera tomorrow that's better than the one.
Isn't that the way? I had that experience with a movie camera, and I think that's kind of a dilemma we have. I waited and waited and waited, and consequently almost lost the young years of our children's lives because I was waiting for a camera that was the latest. That seems to be the dilemma that we find ourselves in now, and that's a tough one to live with. They do become obsolete so fast. Yes.
I was wondering if you had any data on these lost civilizations that apparently had quite a lot of progress, and then they've lost it. Have you had any like in South America, they see some evidences of having had more advancement than we give them credit for.
I'm not an expert on that, other than perhaps to restate what you've stated, that there is evidence that there was just quite sophisticated mathematical systems in South America, and that as South America was, the conquest of South America took place, a great deal of that was decimated. We lost a great deal of that, but it is interesting to see that other civilizations have progressed in those ways. Stonehenge in England, I think, I'm not familiar with it, but I have a sketchy understanding of it, that is a rather precise calendar, isn't it? Astronomical calendar.
And I guess further, I was thinking about what might happen to some of our systems. Maybe they're destroying themselves, or maybe these destroyed themselves for some reason that we don't know about.
Einstein made the statement, he wasn't sure what kind of weapons would be used for the Third World War, but he said he was almost certain that the Fourth World War weapons would be bows and arrows.
I think our upcoming problem with machines replacing man is unemployment.
Yeah,
that's going to be the problem. They used to say for a while, when technology came into the picture, well, if it replaced man, that man could be used to make these things. But that's no longer true. And you see that in the auto industry,
yes,
at least it's going to get worse.
Yeah.
The man that's unemployed or laid off can't go back to his original job because it's been replaced by automation.
That's a severe question, I think, facing our society. I've heard I would guess it's a sociologist, I heard some numbers that within 15 to 20 years, the 40-day work week, or even the steady work week, will be unknown in our society, and that we need to deal with that question of what happens when we can't do good, solid work. Clearly, that is part of our spiritual makeup, or at least it's tied into our spiritual makeup, and that's going to be a severe question. Yes, I've heard that as computers are introduced, there are going to be needs for fixing them, repairing them, and that sort of thing. I have a computer that I work on that hasn't broken in 3 years. And the chips are becoming so reliable. The little chip again, that little insidious device, they're becoming so reliable that, in fact, they're handling themselves fairly free. Error-free computers are being produced today. Even when they fail, they tend to not mend themselves, but they work around it. I don't think we're going to have a huge computer service business. Yes?
What is the fear of computers being, almost might say, vandalized by, for instance, the kids back east that broke the code?
Mm-hmm. The Newsweek. Mm-hmm.
That's kind of scary, too. What's your opinion on that?
The matter of computer security and vandalization and that sort of thing is a matter of, let me approach it this way. Computer systems can be made secure. It simply costs money to do it. That's all. And it's a trade-off. We're going to have to balance off how much we're willing to risk with that regard over and against some cost to protect it. Security within computer systems can be made quite solid, but it comes at a cost. So that's simply an issue we're going to have to look at in those kinds of terms.
Are they looking at it now?
Oh yes, that is a major consideration within the data processing and computer industry.
That was a major concern.
Yeah, it is a major concern.
Related to this, it is a great concern. Turn of mine, we're all computerized, and I have a cartoon where I'm sitting by a computer and I'm on the telephone with Mrs. Rosencrantz, and I'm saying, Mrs. Rosencrantz, our computer says that your bill for spaying your cat is $8,264.25. it would certainly be a lot easier for you to pay that for, than for us to change our computer. There is an insidious thing here. If you rob a bank today, there's a fairly high probability you'll be caught. Your average take is probably in a few hundreds to lower thousands on a bank robbery. You may get 20 years in a hard reformatory or penal institution. If you're involved in sort of white-collar crime, embezzlement, you'll get considerably less time than that, and you'll probably be in a far better facility. If you're in computer crime, and I think there's a lot of computer crime going on, I'd like your comment on this, where they say, oh, it was a computer error. The computer made a mistake. I'm not so sure that a lot of these errors are programmed in for actually fleecing us. And there's some good evidence to prove that. And furthermore, if you're a computer crime, some of those takes have been up into billions of dollars. And the person may get off scot-free if he tells him how he did it. I'd like your comments on that.
There have been cases where computer programmers have programmed events to take place after they have left the company. There are just all kinds of opportunities for that to take place by the technologists. So it does represent, I think, a place where we become more and increasingly vulnerable to our technological systems. I think the computer area is just very fertile for that sort of thing to take place. And I think it does represent a very significant problem for us, this general one of being highly dependent upon a super complex type of system and simply presenting us with problems like this that are almost unresolvable or just extremely difficult for us to handle. Yes, that possibility is very real for us and very scary for us. And it represents an enormous amount of control potentially placed in the hands of a relatively small technologically elite. And that's a problem.
Okay.
I wanted to comment. We haven't made many changes for the length of the work week, for the length of the work day, and so on. But as we computerize, we're going to have to give much thought to the social aspects of the thing. We've talked a lot about how the computer keeps it being improved and the technology keeps getting more advanced. But as we replace people by robots, we're going to have more leisure time, which it seems to me that the arts and some of those things are going to have to be emphasized more than they have in the past. We have a whole area here that we're going to have to do a lot of exploring in the next few years.
I think your point is an excellent one. We need to rethink some of the things we do. Wednesday session, as I mentioned, is going to be what happens when we can completely reconstruct what the New York Philharmonic Orchestra can play, when some high school student in his bedroom with his Apple 12E or whatever he might have by that time can reproduce that. I think it raises questions about what it means to make music or what it means to be creative. And I think we have a whole lot of questions like that that we need to deal with. Yeah, I concur.
Unfortunately, our social aspect and getting along together has not kept pace with the rate at which our technology has gone. What can we do about that?
That's the question.
That, I think, is tied in with this. Yeah, I think that's tied in with this previous question. I think we need to, with great intentionality, be looking at what all this technological progress means to us in terms of societal questions and spiritual questions. We need to be in that process of talking about these things. And you're right, we have lagged so far that I think we find ourselves now caught in a situation where it's uncomfortable for us, and it ought to be uncomfortable for us. We need to be about that process. When I first told Larry Rasmussen I'd come to do these sessions, I didn't think it was quite as big an issue as I do now. I hadn't spent much time looking at my journals. Generally, they just seem to pile up, and I end up with about 3 feet of technical journals that I pass through and look at the ads from time to time. But I haven't done this kind of thing, and it is scary for me, and you're probably experiencing the same thing. Yes.
Don't you believe there's got to be a lot of new definitions, designed and promulgated as a result of this new technology that keeps on multiplying?
New definition of terms, you mean?
Yes, new definitions of law and so on and so forth.
In ethics.
And ethics. Yes, I do think that is a need. We need to look at the whole structure of what is happening to society as a result of it. Again, I refer you back to David Bella's tape on What Is Time. He does an excellent job of talking about how technology has put us into such a time frame that everything we do is based against what that clock says. Chris, the young woman who led us last night in liturgy, and I were talking yesterday at breakfast or lunch or one of the meals, and she said she had spent a good deal of time in the Philippines, and she said when you schedule something there for 2 o'clock, it might start at 3. And I thought, oh, how ghastly. There's no way in the United States that would happen. And if you don't show up by 2:05 for something like this, it just evaporates. We're on such a fixed time schedule. And when you think about that, there are some very practical reasons why that's happening, and that is in other places, you just simply can't get to a place reliably. Their transportation system in some cases is such that they simply can't get there. Our technological situation is that we're able to be where we want to be on time. We're able to get access to information when we need it for those meetings that are held exactly at 2 o'clock. And the whole technique thing is wrapped up into that. And we do need to look at those things with different glasses. And it does get into the whole legal aspects, everything. Yeah, I think you're right about that.
So does the stress level, ulcers, heart problems,
they all attend it, though. Yeah, they all attend it.
I'd like to suggest that we've been going through this process for generations. And when the people started using horses for the first time, I don't know how they thought they were going to live with the horse. When the first airplane flew, I don't know how they thought they were going to live with the sky full of airplanes. And man and womankind has been adjusting to this for eons. And I'd like to suggest that I'm not suggesting that we minimize the problem. I think we must take a look at it and be aware of it. But I'm encouraged to think we're going to look at it.
I appreciate your note of optimism. I, however, would use the word not we have adjusted to it so much as we have adapted to it.
Okay.
And the reason I say that is that because at this point, the adaptation has had attendant with it high stress and on down the line. I'm not so sure we have adjusted to it. I think it has been a more of a matter of adaptation. And I think it has been attended by some negative effects. I'm not to say that there isn't something we can do about it. I am in agreement with you on the fact that there are better ways to live within a technological society. There are, and I think those are the kind of things that we need to be talking about, and will be talking about this week. I think
with all this added stress and so forth, life expectancy has gone up.
Our life expectancy has gone up. I think that I'm not so sure about this. This is not my field, but I would suspect that the stress level as we've moved from an agricultural society, for example, where we dig in the dirt, over and against our society now where we're pretty much plastic oriented, I would venture to say that our stress levels have gone up with that.
The answer is to get a pig.
I haven't seen Leo's pig thing yet, but I can hardly wait to see it. I hear it's just fantastic. I guess we're at the end of the hour here.
Is there any work being done on designing robots to attend conventions?
They're possibly. Yeah, they're awesome. Thank you for being here.
Thank you.